everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Ciaffardini. Welcome back to the Ghost Seat Talk podcast experience. Oh man, we are thrilled beyond belief to speak to our next guest. You know, as cinephiles, as film fans, as lovers of film scores, when you go into a movie, you want to be thrilled, entertained, and delighted, and our next guest does that. So whether you're joining a band of misfits or School for Good and Evil, or even planning a heist, make sure you have our next guest with you at all times. Our next guest is a man named Theodore Shapiro. We are extending the invitation to hear from him. He's the destroyer of sound palettes. His latest project is The School for Good and Evil. It's Paul Feig's latest, and it's not another teen movie. He's old school, a true underdog, a sonic spy. He's more than semi-pro. His musical idiocracy is super low, and in short, he is amazingly prolific. Theodore Shapiro, I love you, man. Welcome to the show. How's things in your world?
Things are good, and thank you for that really incredible introduction. I appreciate it.
It just shows the trajectory of your career. I think it's kind of like, you know, you can be lauded and celebrated for being a chameleon, and like you hear it and you go, I can't believe Teddy did that. I would have expected somebody else. So we've got a lot to talk about today. We're excited to have you on the show. Where did it all begin for you? Let's go in the way back machine. You want to talk about your earliest memories?
Sure. Musical? Yeah. I mean, I started playing the piano when I was about 5 or 6. I think I started with my mom sort of showing me how to play Heart and Soul and, you know, things like that. And I just sort of took to it, and I told her I didn't need piano lessons because I pretty much had it all figured out. Thankfully, she persisted in making me take piano lessons, and I studied piano, pretty seriously as a kid. And it was just, music was just always something that I gravitated towards, where I could see that it was something that came more easily to me than, you know, my schoolmates. It was just something that I had a facility with, and at a certain point, I started sort of noodling at the piano, making things up, which I thought was what everybody did when they played piano. Only later did I learn that that's not what everybody does when they play the piano. And sort of from that, I started thinking of myself as a composer even before I was actually doing anything that was really truly composing. And then ultimately it led to getting into it more deeply. And that's the origin story.
You know, it's funny, we think of school, you get into groups and cliques. Were there people who, you know, was did you find yourself gravitating towards the band or the music club?
Not really. I mean, I had varied interests as a kid, and you know, I was a sports kid. I was in bands, and then I had this real interest in classical music as well, through piano, and so I was kind of. I sort of had my fingers in a lot of pies, as they say. I was friends with people who I was in bands with. So in that sense, I did connect with other musicians, but we were also all athletes together and, you know, doing a bunch of things.
You know, when you talk about being interested in composing, did you ever just get to the point where you're listening to, whether it's Columbo or Star Wars, like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. This is how I would take the movie, you know, the narrative.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's hard to pay attention to scores before you start working on them. And, you know, I would find myself frequently, like, I guess occasionally I would watch something that I thought had a ridiculous score and be able to point that out. But I just remember thinking, I mean, this is an example of great film music, but like I would watch John Williams, you know, films that John Williams had scored to sort of figure out what he was doing. and I could pay attention for a little bit, and then I'd just get lost in the movie, and you know, and I'd suddenly, like, we'd be in the middle of a queue, and I wouldn't have wouldn't have noticed that it had started. Now, if I go see a movie, it's like I don't know what the dialogue is doing because I'm so attuned to what the music is doing, and it's actually a terrible affliction. I mean, you are so tuned in, you hear the music cue as soon as it starts, you know, and you kind of can't stop taking notes on what's happening.
Well, don't feel bad in the least. I work for an interior design and architecture firm, and so our bread and butter is the hospitality market. So no matter what hotel you go to, you're always sort of looking, scanning the room. What was the reason for that? You know, the nightstand being that high, that headboard doesn't align with something. It's like once you're in it, you can't turn it off.
I guess that's right, yeah.
But what was like the biggest aha moment for you, to the point where you're playing a piano, you're feeling this swelling in you and just going, yeah, I got to keep doing this. What was the next step after?
You know, the moment for me was, so I went off to college having been told by my parents that that I would ultimately find a sensible thing to do as a profession, and that was not music. I mean, they were supportive of my music, very, very supportive, but not as a job. So I went to college. I started doing theater as an actor and also as a composer, and I just sort of got immersed in that world. And, you know, and in general, it just filled me with a sense that life was too short to do something I didn't really want to do, and that I might as well give a shot to pursuing what my true passion was. And so I think the moment was just declaring myself as a music major at the end of my sophomore year of college. And my parents were very concerned, and they, you know, they came up to Rhode Island to, you know, grill one of my teachers about whether I was talented enough to make it as a professional. And, but at that point, I was really committed to pursuing music, sort of as far as it would take me. And, you know, and I was just obsessed with movies, and all my friends were obsessed with movies. And, you know, like very frequently we would drive out on Fridays to see whatever movie was opening at the theaters. And, you know, we were just all into it. And, I started doing student films as a composer, and it all just went from there.
Well, sometimes whenever you endeavor, whether it's professionally or as a hobby, you get started and you don't know what you don't know. Are the things that you ran into traps that, looking back, you go, I wish I would have known X because it would have gotten me there faster, or I liked doing this because I, you know, going the roundabout way, I found like who I am today?
I mean, do I wish I would have known something? I mean, I actually would answer that in this way. I'm actually grateful for what I didn't know, because, you know, I had a false sense of confidence. Or not false. I had an unexplained sense of confidence that I was going to be able to do the job and have a career doing the job, without really understanding how difficult it is to make it in this profession. And so I'm glad for what I didn't know in that way. And so, and in another way, when I was, so after undergraduate, I went to, I was at Juilliard in New York, and, I had a friend from undergrad who had he was part of a sketch comedy group that had a TV show on MTV called The State. And they needed a composer. And I was like, yeah, I can do it. You know, and I did not know what the fuck I was doing. You know, I had like the paltriest collection of equipment. You know, I basically like did everything with samples. There was no live recording. You know, I had one kind of okay sample box. And I did everything with that, and, you know, and it didn't sound great. You know, I'm grateful in retrospect that I, despite not really having the technical know-how on how to get started, I just dove in and figured it out on the fly. Because ultimately, the job is really about amassing experience and figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And there's no way to do that except for to dive in. And I was lucky to get an early jump on it.
Well, you know, I wish I could take credit for coming up with this, but I'm stealing this. But that's the Mother Teresa approach. You know, somebody asks, how do you do what you do? And she says very simply, I do what I can, where I am, with what I have.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you're making music with a box of matches or,
yeah,
you know, a symphony, it's like, you know, you do what you can. And
yeah,
it's like, You're Rocky. You are, you know,
yeah,
hungry
yeah, yeah,
enough to keep going.
Exactly.
Well, great. You know, the reason I asked that question about what you maybe didn't know or wish you had known is, looking over your career and the number of impressive films in your catalog, there's a big string of comedies. Mm-hmm. And I think back to Elmer Bernstein, who got to a point in his career where he goes, okay, I'm done doing comedies. I'm going to step away after Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if doing something long enough prepares you for the next step or something. Like, you hone your skills in comedy. I know for acting it's tough, and for musically, I imagine it's difficult. But did that prepare you for the next step to do Bombshell and A Simple Favor?
Yeah, I mean, it's too bad that comedy scores are sort of you know, treated as a lesser art form, because first they're very, very hard to do well, you know, in many cases they're so much harder to do than many dramas, because the timing of them is so specific. And a lot of times the target in a comedy is incredibly narrow. You know, in other words, you have to give the audience permission to laugh, but without being, you know, so jokey that it's like you're spoiling the joke by announcing that you're about to watch something funny. You know, in many cases, I think good comedy is about leaving space for, I mean, good comedy scoring is about leaving space for the comedy to happen on the screen. So, you know, it is almost never the case that huge gestures in comedy are funny. It's much more often the case that the comedy comes from just a light touch that leaves the space for the comedy to happen, or by playing the straight man. I mean, that is often the approach that I take with comedy, is just to play it absolutely straight, to play, you know, Spy as a serious spy comedy and Tropic Thunder as a serious action film, and you know, all of that. I think that all of those kinds of movies really benefit from that kind of straight man approach. You know, what I would say is that having scored a lot of comedies and having, you know, written a lot of scores where extreme attention to timing is critical. You know, it certainly makes working on dramas, you know, there's an aspect of it that's easier, which is to say a lot of times the music in a drama can flow over the picture much more. And that can really open up the creative process where you can spend more time writing, not sitting in front of the picture, but away from the picture, allowing yourself to explore ideas based on, even just based on a script or based on theme and character, and trust that some of those ideas will sort of be an interesting counterpoint with the film, will flow over the picture in a good way without having to cleave to every beat of every scene.
I imagine that all composers, I think I heard Hans Zimmer talk about this, where he likes to grab every second of the frame, even like the title cards, you know, when the Universal mm-hmm. logo is flowing or New Line or whatever. And so that actually lets you in to the story and lets you develop some ideas even before you meet the characters. Right. So I imagine that a drama can do that for you. Does that help when you have more runtime versus, you know, trying to hit it quickly? And
every film is its own unique beast. And, you know, I really like movies that are not afraid to, you know, have long stretches without music. You know, I think that the overall aesthetic of the Hollywood film has changed so drastically since the 70s. You know, they're generally much, much more music in films now than there was. And not always for the best. You know, I really like what silence can do for a film. You know, there are films where it's great to have this huge canvas where you're filling up 2 hours of screen time, and that's fun and exciting, and it's a huge canvas to play with. But you know, I also really admire films that pick and choose their spots for music in a careful way.
This morning I was watching Hooper, the old Burt Reynolds movie, and mm-hmm. Bill Justice did that score. And you're right, it was a different era. It was a different time frame. And you think back to, or even something like I was watching Night Moves with Gene Hackman, and it was kind of like the music was, it had the ability to be goofy. It didn't really have to tell the narrative story that we're asking things of a sound palette to do today, because it just seems like you could take it away from the movie and it would still be those movies of that era would still be the same. But I feel like there's something that we're the movie process is so manufactured that if you take the music out, we just lose it, becomes real life, and in a sense a lot of stories that we watch become boring. So
right. Yeah, it's interesting if you watch the Poseidon Adventure, which might be late 60s, it's shockingly lightly scored. I mean, it's a John Williams score. It's a great score, but like scenes that in a modern context would definitely be heavily scored or just played dry. It's really, really interesting to sort of see how those things have evolved over time.
Like I said, I'm really excited to speak to you about Pirates, and I think we're at the 10-year anniversary. So congratulations on putting that out in the film community and the entertainment community for us to partake. I tried to show it to my daughter. She really gets a kick out of it. My favorite part in the whole movie was sort of the albino pirate. He goes, "I've got a badge for looting." It just gives and gives and gives. So, that's a comedy, but that's a stop motion. Does the medium in which the story is told, does that affect or help inform how you're going to write?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, I would say that, you know, for the most part, it's not so different from what you do on any other movie. You're helping the filmmakers tell their story. And you know, obviously, that's another example where the music is taking the approach of playing the the material as sort of a serious pirate movie, but while leaving spaces for the comedy. It was an interesting thing to work on the film. I started on that film very early, and a lot of the music I wrote, when they just had storyboards, sort of before they'd really made it very far at all with the animation process. And one of the things that I did learn on that picture was that there is so much information, especially with stop motion. There's so much information in the frame when you finally see the animated process that storyboards cannot capture. I mean, it's true for all animation, but you know, I think that particularly with stop motion and Aardman, there's just so much joy in the frame, and in certain cases, I wrote some action music in the third act of that movie that once I saw the picture, because I wrote it to storyboards, I realized I was missing sort of a layer of comedy and joyfulness that, you know, you just couldn't get a sense of with storyboards. And so that's an interesting thing with all animation is, you know, I am somebody who likes to start writing early. And with animation, there's a real tension there because a lot of times the joy is in the frame and you kind of, you know, if you wait entirely until the last minute, it's sort of too late, but you kind of need to see that, you kind of need to see that joy to really understand the tone of the film.
I think that's a great word because when I think of the music and the movie, it's colorful and charming. And so from the outside, it seems like, yes, Peter Lord and team did all the work. And then at the very end, you lay over your tarp. And I could see what you mean. If you didn't get that feeling, didn't get to witness what the audience would see, you could miss the mark. So that's very helpful.
Totally. I mean, and luckily, you know, Pete was a very, very good director, and you know, he I think that there were parts in the beginning of my process where I'd write something and he was like, "This is really good, but it's a little American." What does that mean? What does that mean? And then I finally figured out what he meant and what he, the kind of English character that he was looking for. And so once I tapped into that, it was smooth sailing.
Well, I know that as a creative musician and an artist, in order to do your job right, you have to watch picture again and again and again. So are there things that you just, even 10 years, 15 years later, you just can't get out of your head, just whether it's a line or just a scene, it's like, and whether you even put music to it, whether it's just part of the process.
You know, there are, you're talking about in that movie or in general?
Well, let's start, but I think it might be just fun to see what in general, you know, is it a Melissa McCarthy scene? Is it, who knows?
I mean, I think all the time about some of the material in Heist. You know, David Mamet's script is so great. And there are a bunch of scenes with Danny DeVito where just the dialogue is so, it's just so snappy and funny. And I, you know, think about them and quote them all the time, you know, everybody needs money, that's why they call it money, is sort of a classic. And in that same scene, he says, like, I'm going to drop a Roosevelt dime on your ass. Finito la commedia. And it's just a fabulous script. And that was a joy to work on.
Oh, awesome. And I'll go with a pirate's one. That's the part where the pirate captain is looking at the map and he goes, oh, we could have made it if it wasn't for this bloody great sea monster. And
Oh,
then
yeah.
Martin Freeman's character is like, I think that's just thrown on for decoration. He looks at him like he's going to tell him he's an idiot. Oh, good. And then, like, later on, they're looking for a different profession, and pirate captain goes, because I've heard there's a fortune to be made in babies' clothes because babies grow so fast. And I say that to my wife all the time when we were expecting our first and now our second. She still has no clue what it's from. So just funny how us cinephiles just can't get that stuff out of our head.
Really funny.
Well, let's jump into meat and potatoes of this. The let's call it Fanciful Feast, that is The School for Good and Evil, your fifth time working with Paul Feig. Who is the audience for that? That's kind of like, musically, it's all over the map. Story-wise, it's all over the map. It's like source music. I mean, it's a whole lot, but it is fascinating. And I think your theme, it's one of the best fantasy themes, if you want to classify it like that. It's just, I can't stop thinking about it.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you. For the audience, I mean, I think the audience, like, demographics are not really my thing, but I think that it's probably heavily located in the 12 to 25 years old. I think that those books have a pretty big following in that demographic. So I think that's who's watching the movie. And as far as the tone of the score, I would say that it is unified, or hopefully unified, by a general by an attempt to make sort of it both epic and pop, that it has this very, very large orchestra and so many forces, a choir, a Bulgarian choir, and big taiko drums, and a huge ensemble. But a lot of the music is also in some way colored by pop gestures, be it program beats or chord progressions that come sort of more out of that language than classical music. And that was the approach that I took, to just sort of give it a youthful energy that made it feel appropriate for the world of the film. The costumes in the film have this very sort of cool couture vibe to it, and I just felt like the whole world of the film seemed to invite an approach that felt youthful in that way.
Well, trust me, when I say it's all over the map, I mean, it's so beautiful. And what I want to talk to you about is, okay, let's just go from the very first track. Family Duel starts off with some very light string work, soft piano keys. Then it gets into the drums you mentioned, choral, heavy horns. And that's just the first 30 seconds. And then I can go on. But I think that just listening to that one track, it sounds like it could be a demo reel for your entire... not just career, but like your everything that you can do from A to Z. So
yeah,
I'm flabbergasted that you were able to fit all that in, because it just flows so well. And I think that because of the story, having school for good, school for evil, and there's the sort of polarizing dynamic, you kind of had to nebulously find your way through this process. So
yeah, I mean this movie feels like, of everything that I've ever done, it feels like the biggest canvas. We took the approach of having a lot of different themes in the score. I often, you know, I worked on the show Severance, that which is basically a monothematic scoring approach. Not 100%, but largely it's really based around one thematic idea, and it's about sort of expanding as much as possible on one idea. This was something where the two main characters each have their own theme. The School for Good has its theme. The School for Evil has its theme. There's a theme that is really about undermining the idea of things being strictly good or evil. So there's just a lot of there's a lot of motivic information in the score, and there's also a really wide a wide range of musical instrumental input in the score. You know, you've got harpsichords and like recorder, you know, you've got recorders and frame drums and things that sort of harken back to a more medieval sound. You have harpsichords, which evoke a more Baroque sound. And then, you know, you've got this orchestra that's playing a more, you know, late 19th century, 20th century sound. And then these modern programmed ideas. So, you know, the world of the film is so large and so encompassing that, you know, I wanted to sort of play with this giant stew of different musical influences.
Well, yeah, you said harpsichord and you also said taiko drums earlier. And then yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the program beats, because I was just looking through like all of this stuff that I was writing, all these things that are things I think I'm hearing. You had like tribal beats, and there was an organ at one point, and lutes and Irish flutes. It was like, it just, take that, Howard Shore, take that, Lord of the Rings. This is pure fantasy, just because it's like, it could be anything. So, get off praise horse.
No, well, thank you. I really appreciate it, and I'm glad that all came through. I think a lot about, it's not very clever, but like, I think a lot about this sort of stew metaphor. You know, I love the idea with each project of sort of figuring out sort of what flavors are going to go in and trying to combine, you know, unlikely pairings. And this was one where there are a lot of instruments, a lot of ingredients in the stew. And so I'm glad that they came through as distinct ideas and not just a big giant mush of sounds.
Well, there's also something that was, I'm just going to say it was unexpected based on the type of story this was. There's a lot of source music. And so as a composer, do you get an opportunity where you just go, I got so much going on, put as much source music as you want? Or do you just want to be like, no, this is really going to muddy the waters?
In general, I thought with this movie, it was really clear that the film wanted those source music moments. It, you know, especially to just give it a different identity than the Harry Potter franchise. I think it was just helpful to, you know, to have a world where songs were, you know, were welcome, was just a useful, that was just a useful technique to separate it from the Harry Potter world, because there obviously are, you know, narrative similarities. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. So I've been doing this job for, I don't know, around 25 years, and if you if I think back to the beginning of my career, you know, like in the late 90s, soundtracks were huge business, and as such, most films that you worked on, there was a little bit of an emphasis on getting songs in the film, because every film was like an opportunity to sell a soundtrack. And that aspect of you know, that aspect of the industry really shaped the experience of working on a film. It felt like every big moment in a film, the hope was you could put a song there. And I would say that as the industry evolved, you know, as the money went out of the record business and then streaming came along, that impetus for songs kind of dried up a little bit as the money dried up. And so, you know, whereas I would say earlier, it sort of often felt like, oh, come on, I want the opportunity to score the scene and not just have another song. Now there's a little bit less of a fight. Now it feels like the decisions are really being made for creative reasons. And I just don't feel like I'm fighting with directors and music supervisors over the real estate. You know, it feels like a pretty happy, it feels like we've landed in a happier place. That might just be my experience. And, you know, I have a lot of recurring director relationships and maybe I just work with good people. but that's been my experience.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, because that made me think something like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. That was very song heavy, but David Newman had a great score for it.
Yeah.
There was no source music in The Rocketeer. But then you look at it, which was the 90s. Then there was like Friday. That was a perfect opportunity to sell a soundtrack.
Yeah.
Speed was score heavy.
Yeah.
And then it just went on from there. So I see that. And then you look at something like even Netflix's Bridgerton takes contemporary songs, but then symphonizes them, harmonizes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. I haven't seen Bridgerton. But,
okay. There's so much Netflix stuff. Nobody blames you.
There's so much
out there. So I guess if it befits the story, you know, whether it's an Armageddon or a Deep Impact, I know it, I guess it just depends. So, well, let me ask you something as your career has gone over, you've worked with so many, creative minds. And when you look at picture or having dialogue with a director, do you find that when you get to work, your creative process, you look for inspiration, or you need creatives to like throttle you back? You know, do you
say that again?
Yeah. Do you sort of chase inspiration, like to get you going, or do you just have so many ideas you need the people whose vision to throttle you back and be like, okay, rein you in a bit?
No, I mean, I would say that I am, I'm inspired by the input that I get. You know, I read a script or see a cut of a film, and that provides my, you know, that provides my impetus. So I'm a puzzle person. I like crossword puzzles and jigsaw puzzles and, you know, Wordle and Sudoku and all that. And that's sort of how I approach every project. You know, every score is like this code to be cracked. Whether it's, you know, coming up with the right melody or coming up with the right combination of sounds, or, you know, some sort of unique character that gives the score its identity. And that's kind of what drives me a little bit. You know, so I'm not like, when I'm not writing a film score, like I don't come in to, you know, I don't like have a symphony that I want to write. I kind of need an assignment. And because that really activates my desire to like figure out what the solution is. And that's what gives me a pleasure and motivation.
Okay. No, that's great. I mean, everybody has a different way of working. And the reason I ask is because I think I'm like you. I don't just, you know, I don't live to work. I work to live. And so when there's an opportunity to, you know, try three different ideas, I'll try three different ideas, but it's not like I'll spend, every waking moment, just trying to, you know, I have 37 ideas and I need somebody to really say, hey, we got to rein you in because you're getting away from yourself. But, you know, it's like one good idea is better than 37. So focus on that puzzle and crack it up wide open.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that, like, if I'm not satisfied with something that I'm working on, then I'll be obsessive about it until I feel that I've gotten it right, or that I'm happy with it. If there's something bothering me, if there's some sense that, like, I haven't gotten, you know, if I haven't cracked the code, then I will torture myself and be awake in the middle of the night until I come in and solve it.
Well, the last thing is, in the film, there was a great line between Agatha and Kerry Washington's character where she says, you destroy something because they can't live up to your impossible expectations. So I'd like you to turn this on you. Do you work in such a way that you're like, it's never good enough? I mean, do you throw stuff away, or do you keep all these little song starts and just in hopes that maybe you could use it somewhere else? Like, how do you like to work?
I rarely do that. I mean, I don't know. I'm not even sure I've ever done that. I just find that every project is its own unique thing, and I'm rarely pulling something out of the archive and putting it in. It just, like, it never works. It's never the right thing. So I don't do that. But in general, like, I don't believe in, like, trying to save ideas, like having an idea and think, like, you know, oh, I'm going to save this for another movie. Like, I just like to burn it all and, you know, you use it up and then start with the blank canvas again.
I respect that. That is a great approach. I ask because I have an expression where I say it's not right, but it's not for right now. I even forget how I said my own phrase, but it's the idea that, like, just because it's not working doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just not right for, you know, what we're doing. So we try to save
and
it.
That's great. And you know, maybe one of these days I will write a great theme that I use for a different project, but it just hasn't happened for me yet.
All right. After 25 years in the business, when is the right time,
yeah,
Teddy? So why don't we round this out with some fun questions? The site that I run does a lot of reviews and interviews with composers who do wonderful things, but also have a relationship with Mondo, in that Mondo and Death Waltz release those wonderful scores. So you have The Invitation, and then you have Destroyer.
Yep.
Do you think we can get a line in to maybe get Pirates, Bands, and Misfits?
Hey, I would love it. I would absolutely love it. You know, by all means, pester them. That would be great. Mondo is incredible. They do the most beautiful vinyl pressings. You know, the artwork is always amazing. I'd love to partner with them whenever possible. And it's been great working with them on The Invitation and Destroyer. They did just great artwork on both of those. I think I'm clear to say that they are working on something for Severance, which should be absolutely spectacular. So I'm excited for people to see that.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm happy for you. And I see some commonalities in The Invitation, the score to that, and Severance. Can you talk about maybe did those two line up, or am I just making that up?
Well, let's see. Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's definitely a similarity of, you know, they're both very spare. and they both use solo strings in a similar way. I think that both of them sort of employ space in I think that's where the commonality is.
Okay. So fun question number one. Let's just say you've got a cue approved, one, the puzzle that you've been trying to crack, whether you just got your favorite score released on vinyl, whatever it is. What is your happy dance? What's your victory dance? What do you do when you just like, yes, we did it. Today is a great day.
That's funny. I would say that my happy dance is probably, it's probably just taking a walk. That's, I work in a studio with some other composers, and there's just like a lovely walk. If I step outside the studio, I can stretch my legs, and I live in Los Angeles, so the weather is usually great. And it's just a very, it's just a really nice thing to step out of the cave of the studio and into the sunlight and feel the sun and warmth on your body. And so when I have a victory at work, I often celebrate with a little walk.
Okay. I was really expecting like a Judd Nelson fist in the air.
Oh, I see. You wanted like a victory dance. I don't think I have a satisfying answer.
Don't roll like that.
Sorry.
Okay. Or let's go back to Not Another Teen Movie. Ben Folds, if I get my facts right, he wrote the Prom Tonight song. Did you have anything musically, production-y?
I did an orchestral arrangement for it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember very much
about okay.
a really long time ago, but I did the orchestral arrangement.
Okay, so maybe next time you get a cue approved, you walk outside and like freeze at the end of a end of a musical number.
Exactly.
So I imagine working with world-class musicians or you playing music yourself, are there any recordings that you've held on to? Like, this day was special, or this musician, played something crazy, or we just tried something, it was so goofy.
So there are so many examples of that, but the first thing that pops to my mind is I worked a couple times with Caroline Shaw, who's just a absolutely brilliant composer and musician, and she did the vocals for Bombshell, or some of the vocals for Bombshell, the majority, and also we did an improvisational session together for the pilot of the TV show Yellow Jackets, and she is just a total genius and a joy to work with. And we just had, a couple of moments. She was out recording both violin and vocals. And I was sort of there sort of giving her vague hand gestures. And she somehow sort of just knew what each vague hand gesture meant. Like we were just sort of mind melding a little bit. And it was thrilling. She's about as great a musician as you can be. And it was just one of those moments where I just felt very, very lucky that she would that she would deign to work with somebody like me. And it was a real joy.
So I guess last question. So Paul Feig is known for being always dapper, always dressed to the heels.
Yeah.
Do you have a picture of him in like, board shorts and
no
tank top or something?
Never happens.
Never
happens. I have been with him on a Saturday at my studio at 10 in the morning. He is in a three-piece suit dressed to the nines.
Wow.
The only time he's ever not in a suit is when we do if we do a test screening of something and he doesn't, and he wants to you know, he doesn't want to stand out or sort of be the focus of attention. He'll just sort of wear civilian clothing, still very immaculate, but it's not just for the cameras that he puts on the suit. The suit is his uniform, mm-hmm. and that's what he does.
Well, but that's his mindset. That's just like, he just feels that that's in him to present himself well. And
for sure. I mean, we all have a uniform. you know, I definitely have a uniform, and that just happens to be his.
Excellent. Well, maybe I should send back the shirt I got him that said tacos are the most important meal of the day. I would never wear it.
He appreciated the gesture, but I think he's having a hard time integrating it into the wardrobe. Yeah.
Just kidding. Theodore Shapiro, everybody. Please check out The School for Good and Evil. Look forward to possibly some severance magic coming from Mondo. And Teddy, why don't you take us out? Anything else you're cleared to tell us? Anything you got going on in your world that you want to broadcast?
I'm starting to work on the second season of Severance. They've recently started shooting, and so I'm just sort of working on new themes, and I'm just starting to work on the new Trolls movie, which should be really fun. Those guys are the best. They're really wonderful, funny, nice people, the filmmakers, and so I've got some fun stuff ahead of me.
Well, our ears are waiting. We will catch you next time.